This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, the studio is all decorated here for Halloween, and it's funny, this morning I got a photo from my son in Madison, Wisconsin, and he said, "What is this mysterious white stuff all over the place?" Oh, for a boy who's born in Texas and raised in Florida, that white stuff, baby, is snow. And yes, we used to have snow. Usually we had snow for Halloween when I was a kid up in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. I'm a Youper, and we always look forward to snow. And so, he had snow, as he's discovered ever since he moved to Madison. Yes, there is such a thing as snow, and it is heavy. That's what he discovered, shoveling it last year. Anyway, so I am so happy. I'm really thrilled today. I have a wonderful author back on Joy on Paper today. Brooke Allen is a fantastic author, and she takes after a friend of mine, Margaret George, who lives in Madison. So she also discovered snow, which is funny. Hi, Brooke. How are you?
I am great. Thanks so much for having me again, Patsy.
Okay, well, it's a thrill to have you back because we're going to be talking about the second in your trilogy, and the new book is called Antonius, Second in Command. And, of course, the first one was Antonius, a Son of Rome. And I tell you, Brooke, you have done a fantastic, fantastic job with this book.
Thank you so much. It was just a real fun journey to explore more of the battlefields and just the history surrounding Antony's life. It really was.
Well, you know, Mark Antony is such a famous character in history, thanks to his relationship with Cleopatra. So, you know, but there's so much more to him than just those years. So often in history, that's all they talk about. And so we have those years that he spent with her, and then his downfall. But the years building up to that are so fascinating. And in this new book, we find him on the Appian Way, actually, which is funny, because when my husband and I, we on one of our honeymoons, we had several honeymoons, but one of them, we took the Appian Way. We went right down from Rome, and we went all the way across Italy, down and across Italy to Brindisi. So I know that area very well, and you have brought the Appian Way just in the opening of the book, the way you write about it. I was so thrilled with this, how you did it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, actually, I was able to place several scenes on the Appian Way in this particular book, and it is one of my happy places. I've got several happy places in Rome, and the Appian Way is just, you can just use your imagination so much while walking along it, and certainly, you know, your imagination thinks of the legions, but when you see the tombs, it's like, wow. What all went on here? What festivals did they have honoring the dead? And you know, what kind of thievery was going on, you know, during that time? And they had traffic jams, just as I depicted, you know, at the beginning of the book.
I know, and I thought it's little details like that which make a reader realize that, boy, first of all, this author knows her stuff, and she has just done her research, and she's got us in this place. And that's why I think this book is, I mean, once you start reading it, it's so filled with all of these just little things. I mean, like, no one ever would think that there was a time where, you know, nowadays we're always controlling traffic and trying to figure out, you know, when trucks can go down certain highways. And they had that problem then. And to realize that how alive the area was, of course, one of the things, you know, there were trucker stops along the way. Oh boy, nothing's changed. You know, this is what makes history so much fun. You discover
it does.
Things haven't changed that much.
Yes, exactly right. You know, and I think that it's important as an author to try to point that out to the reader, to make them realize that, gee, you know, there are aspects of the ancient world that can still touch us today. You know, they weren't so different than we are. So
that's right. And although we hope along our trucker alleys that there aren't a lot of unknown children left behind.
Oh, goodness.
But
exactly.
Definitely. In those days, so many of them did run wild. And so it lent the whole atmosphere of that road of what life was like in those days and how you describe it. I thought made it really a fascinating story.
Yeah, it's really been quite a journey, and being able to actually go over there and see some of the places that I do describe and that I do talk about, to me, just has really made it more important to really describe and try to depict for people what it was like back then versus today. I end the story, for example, on the top of a huge theater in the ancient city of Philippi, that was named after Philip of Macedon, Alexander the Great's father. And Philippi is where the great battle between Brutus and Cassius and the armies of Antony and Octavian takes place. And I had such an amazing experience up on top of the diazoma of the theater, looking out over the battlefield, and again, using my crazy imagination, trying to think about what it would have been like the day of the battle or the day after the battle. And so that's where I chose to actually end the book, is having Antony up on top of that theater and just looking out over it, and what would it have been like? What would it have smelled like? I really wanted to bring the five senses into this book. And that's how you really make a reader sense and appreciate what's going on in the story. They have to feel it.
Absolutely. And you do it so beautifully and so seamlessly. You take us into the story, as I said, having, for me, you know, having been on the Appian Way, and today so much of it is just very quiet, open area, you know, no people. I mean, you can go actually walk for miles and not run into anyone. And my husband and I were driving a white Cadillac. So we were on a parallel, and then we'd have to get out and go, you know, to the actual area, because you can't exactly drive a white Cadillac.
Oh, you can, not on those roads.
Not on those roads. But we had this opportunity, and you'd go there, and now it's very quiet and it's very peaceful. And but to think of it being, you know, so busy and so many people, going along the road, going across Italy, all the business that was going on, all the exciting life that was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think when people, so many people, I think, will read this and they'll say, you know, people like go to Italy and they go to Rome, or they might go to a few cities. They might go to Venice, but if somebody ever wants to make a real trip to Italy, to follow the Appian Way, one, because along the way there are so many smaller towns where you get treated so nicely, and the food is so good, and it really harkens back. You think, yes, you know, when they were the Romans were, you know, there traveling along, you know, that we imagine. And as you said, the food and the smells and the how they bake bread. Oh my gosh, you know, it's amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Oh, the food over there. We discovered pasta carbonara this year, and we came home, and my husband and I decided we've got to make this stuff. And we have perfected our own little recipe of, you know, pasta carbonara, so that we can have Rome right there in our little kitchen in Virginia. So.
Well, now tell us about this second in command. Now, this as we open up this story, Marcus is you know, thinking about his first wife, who we met in the first book, and someone he loved very much. So take us through the story and how it develops.
Yeah, the big premise of this story and the plot, I would say, is his rise to Julius Caesar's side as second in command. And when the story opens, he is still grieving his first wife. She has tragically died, and he has remarried. He's about to become a father for the first time, and but not everything is happy in his life. You know, his personal life, you know, he's had such a terrible series of events occur, but, you know, he's still trying to get over all of that. And as he finally does, you know, become accepted as one of Caesar's staff, he has to travel north because the Gallic War is going on, and he has to join Caesar in that effort. And I think Marcus really discovers just how huge and all-consuming a huge campaign can be. And from then on, he becomes completely wrapped up in all of these huge campaigns that Caesar has, whether it's against the Gauls, whether it's against, you know, Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus, you know, his great rival. And Antony becomes a huge tool of Caesar's. Caesar does recognize his talents, but Caesar also, I think, knows his foibles. And Antony becomes rather frustrated in my story because Caesar likes Antony, you know, to stay in Rome and to kind of hold up his ideas and political ideologies there, and instead of being on the battlefield. And, you know, that was where Marcus felt like he had the strength, was on the battlefield. And he felt like that was his gift, his talent. And, you know, he often becomes very, very frustrated with Caesar in that regard. Caesar and Antony don't always have the perfect relationship, and that really, I think, surfaces towards the middle of my book. And, of course, along comes the Ides of March, and that leads to yet another huge military campaign, series of military campaigns, actually. And Antony is right in the center of them, is now contesting power to become the first man in Rome. And what's funny is he kind of looks back on his life and realizes, wow, I never really wanted to be the first man in Rome, but here I am, there it is. And that's kind of where he is, and he has to seek out, what is my destiny going to be? And to survive and to try to continue the peace that he so kind of unbalancedly creates with Octavian, he feels like maybe his fortune lays more in the East. If I can stay here and if I can man, you know, this part of the Roman world, perhaps we can keep the peace. And that's kind of where everything ends, and, of course, a good setup for my third novel.
Absolutely. Well, the, and the thing is, as I said, you are such a really excellent writer that you take us to the place. And I even little things like the trip from Rome up north, going through Gaul, you know, now we think, oh, it's a pleasant journey through France. But
it was not back then.
There were some challenges. So tell us how you brought that into the story, how you explained it, and how what that journey through France, where he went up north, traversed France to get to where Caesar was had set up camp, and all of the things that they had to do. They were fighting this group and that group. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, you know, we think of France now, and we think of a very civilized and very, you know, cuisine-oriented, arts-oriented country. Whereas, you know, the French originated in Gaul, and France was this basic, kind of a frenzied bunch of tribes that just didn't get along. And they extended all the way into what is now Germany and Belgium, and even into Holland, parts of Holland, and into Switzerland as well. And all of these tribes were at odds. Now, there was a point in time in Roman history where, I think it was in around the 3rd or 4th century B.C., where they actually attacked Rome and they sacked Rome. And by the way, Rome apparently used to be on a bit of a grid, and now if you go there, it's just this circuitous mess of streets, and I think a lot of that may have originated with that sacking back in the 3rd or 4th century B.C., and they just left it that way. And so there are these circuitous little roads all over Rome, whereas every place else in the empire, you go and everything's laid out on a grid very neatly, because that was the typical Roman design. But getting back to Gaul, Julius Caesar had decided, I've got to have a conquest, and when he went up there, he wanted to prove to the Senate that he was all-powerful, and he did instigate a war. A lot of people could say that he could be blamed for killing, you know, cold-bloodedly killing almost an entire tribal group. You know, there were several tribal groups that he almost annihilated. Then there were several that he made peace with. The Aedui were some of them. And when Antony entered Gaul, they were just starting to have problems with the Aedui peace pact, and that was just about to fall apart. Caesar had also opened another can of worms by trying to get to Britannia, and I'm sure that there are scholars who debate this, but some people think, oh, it was great that he went to Britannia, but I don't see that he achieved that much. If anything, it kind of weakened his position by leaving Gaul and traveling over there and making such a big deal about it, trying to make his mark over on the British Isles. We don't know for certain if Antony was with him, but in this portrayal, I do depict that he did go. Whether he did or not, it was certainly around the time that he probably arrived to join Caesar as a legate. So that's the way it was depicted in my novel.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. You know, I had never thought of Antony going to Britannia, but it's possible. You know, he was there.
It's possible.
And he was of course, Caesar's distant cousin. And in some ways, I think Caesar, you know, he was torn between wanting to help him and then wanting, always there's this element of jealousy between these strong men, you know, that you don't mm-hmm. want him to take over. So, but you have certainly painted a fascinating picture of it, and then of course we get you know, Marcus back in Rome. We have tell us about his new wife and what were the dynamics there with the his second marriage and before he went on before the Ides of March. When everything sort of started going really crazy in Rome.
You know, I have to laugh because, you know, Mark Antony was sort of the female Elizabeth Taylor. He was married so many times. And, you know, really marriage didn't work very well for him, unfortunately. And, you know, you got to understand, too, that almost all marriages back then were arranged marriages. And, you know, I think that when his second marriage occurred, it must have been one that nobody was real thrilled about. It was to his cousin, and you know, we would consider that incestuous because she was his first cousin. However, in Roman times, it wasn't necessarily incest. It was allowed, although it was starting to be frowned upon. And so when he did marry Antonia, I don't know that there was a great deal of advantage to it. And it must have been a situation in his family where it was necessary. You know, she was needing protection. Her father, Antonius Hybrida, was being exiled at one point in the story, and poor little Antonia had no place to go. I pose it as though she had been married. We don't know if she had been previously married, but I pose it as that she was. And nothing much is said about that marriage, but she, in my story, is a very shy person, very retiring, not real socially adept. She's not stupid, but at the same time, she's not good at making her own independent choices, as the book, you know, definitely reveals.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The third wife, of course, is Fulvia. And Fulvia was quite the piece of work. She's not always a very pleasant character. She is involved in a lot of rebellion later on in the story, and I'll be getting into that in my third book. So that's going to be a real interesting part and interesting texture to the story. And I'm gonna have to really be careful how I do that, because, of course, I'm doing all of this through Antony's point of view, and he won't even be in Italy when that occurs. So that's going to be... that's going to be tricky to pull that off. Hopefully I'll be able to. So.
Well, I'm sure you'll figure it out, because you are you are really so talented. And I think that it's just wonderful. Of course, you've had Margaret George, who is, you know, such a brilliant author. And she is she is such a great supporter of yours. And I saw that you got a very nice blurb from Michelle Moran, who wrote Cleopatra's Daughter.
I know. She was so kind to do that for me.
Yeah, she wrote, I'm going to want to read it. She wrote, "Second in Command is a wonderful addition to the pantheon of literature featuring the always fascinating Mark Antony. An exciting read." That's nice.
Yeah. I tell you, when you have an author of her caliber or Margaret's write something pleasant on the front of your cover, you know, you just sigh and your tingles go through your whole body, because, you know, truly, you know, we authors, we try so hard to please, and it's a tough industry, and we are trying our best to scramble up the ladder to success. And it has been such a blessing to have both of these ladies definitely in my corner.
Well,
it's much appreciated.
They are, and they love your work, and it is so good. And you have a wonderful website. It's, first of all, the cover of the last book, Antonius, Son of Rome, is gorgeous, and I love the new cover. It's just isn't it fantastic?
Well, you know, I told actually my cover designer, and I'm going to say this, I hope you don't mind, Jennifer Quinlan, she is an incredibly talented lady. She's also my editor. And she does amazing work. And I told her, I said, you know, we had him from the back the last time, you know. And I said, I'd really love to have, you know, to have his face showing. You know, let's show the world what Antony looked like. And I'll never forget, I was sitting at a restaurant having dinner with some neighbors, and her email came through, you know, throwing out the different faces of models on stock art that we could possibly use. And I found this guy's face, you know, amongst her pictures, and I thought, oh my word, she's found Marcus. How did she do that? You know, I was so floored, because I thought those piercing eyes and everything, this is exactly what I would, you know, that I tried to describe in my story. So I thought she did a phenomenal job, and we wanted him in a toga, and we both found out how few togate men there are online in stock art, but we were able to do some magic, or she was, and it just worked out so well.
It is. It's really, really beautifully done, and very distinctive. Now, tell people about your website. It's called Brooke Allen Author, okay, everybody?
And Brooke Allen Author.
And it's done without an E. So it's brookeallenauthor.com. It's a great website. It's very beautiful. And I love that you have this. Well, first of all, you have a lot of your research info there. And also, you do a very nice blog. And I like your stories. And people should really, they can sign up for your newsletter and read your blog, because it's anybody who's interested in Italy, interested in history, will find it fascinating, because you bring in a lot of things, and of course there's a lot of pictures of you having fun traveling around, and you have made this a real life investment in doing this research and making, really bringing to life Marcus Antonius for all of us, and I think you've done a brilliant job, Brooke.
Well, thank you. Yeah, the website has just been a labor of love. It has taken me some time to learn a little tricks on the computer, because I'm afraid I'm not the world's best when it comes to technology, but I am learning a little as I go, and I find folks who are kind enough to help me along the way, which is awesome. I felt like I needed to do a bibliography that was not part of my original website, And so this summer, I kind of got serious about that, sat down, and pulled out a whole lot of books.
You did a beautiful job. Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you so much for being on the program today, Brooke. It's Brooke Allen, and everyone, you can go there to her website, Brooke Allen. Author.com. You can follow her on Facebook and just enjoy, and also, you know, make sure that you get the new book. I think the second in the trilogy, and everyone, you will just love it. So again, Brooke, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you so much for having me, Patsy. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, we'll take a commercial break, and when we come back, I have another author coming on. Fascinating. It's every once in a while I get an author who links up with things that I've done in my past, too. So I'm looking forward to talking to Elaine Adams in a little while.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I am excited. I'm going to be away on Thursday, but there will be a program. I've taped it, and because I am going to be in Dallas, Texas for BoucherCon, and this is really exciting for me. I'm so looking forward to seeing many of the authors that have been on Joy on Paper, and many I'm sure I will meet, and I will invite them to be on in the next few months, and it's really always so exciting to talk to mystery authors, and Joy on Paper's best friends will be there, and I am so happy that I will get to see Lawrence Block, who is a mystery writer of America Grandmaster, and he will be on the program also at the end of the year because he has another anthology coming out. So I'm really looking forward to seeing him over there, and I'm just waiting now. Okay. Well, you know, it's so funny. I lived in England for many years. My husband and I traveled a lot to Scotland. And so when I got the next author's books, I was really thrilled. And I am so happy to have on the program Elaine Adams. And we're going to be talking about her newest book, The Rubicus Prophecy, Witches of Orkney. And it's book two. And hi, Elaine.
Hey, good morning, Patsy. How are we doing?
Okay, well, this is exciting. You know, as I said, I went to Scotland a lot, and not too many people know about the Orkneys, and so it was really thrilling when I got your books, and I realized how you brought them to life in the story that a really wonderful fantasy series for young people. Although I'm not good as I am on old people, but I love it just as much as any young kid.
Well, that's the goal, to write a book that both adults and kids like, okay? That's the challenge, but that's also the fun.
Well, I think it is, and it's wonderful if you have, kids reading this level of book. I don't know what's the age. It's marketed for a certain age, sort of mid-teens or teens.
No, it's a junior middle grade. So this particular book, The Witches of Orkney series, is really for the younger kids, like third, fourth, fifth, even sixth grade.
Oh,
so
wow. It's a fantasy series,
but with the younger reader in mind that's not ready to challenge, like an 80,000-word book. These are more like 40,000 words.
Yeah, well, it's for me, too. I love it. Well, first of all, I will tell you something. I read a lot of books for kids and a lot of what I found in your books, it's so touching. You have you're of course an excellent writer, but you also have dialogue that I think is important for children to read and for adults to read, because there is in your books you have a lot of love and caring and sharing, and the hope that kids will be kind. Because as I'm reading the dialogue, I come along to different places, and I want to read one particular little bit of dialogue for my listeners. And it's between Robert and Hugo. And you can later on explain who they are. But I thought it was so touching as they're walking along, and Robert says, "I thought you were more of a scientist, not into all the hocus-pocus witch stuff." "I am a scientist, Verse, but one who appreciates magic." They crawled along the shaft until it reached a T-section. "Which way?" Robert asked. "The classrooms are to the left." "So right it is." Robert turned and scrambled along. The only sound was a dripping water, an occasional screech of rathos that ducked out of sight at the first sign of activity. After a series of left and right turns, Robert halted, looking worriedly over his shoulder. "How are we going to find our way out of here?" he asked, panting. Hugo held up his pencil. "I've been marking our turns." Robert's brow went up. "You're not half bad for a scientist." "Not so useless, am I? Sorry about that. I say the dumbest things. I don't mean them. I just, sometimes my mouth runs." That little bit of dialogue I thought was so clever and so appropriate for everybody to read, to show that, yes, people, have ideas about somebody, and then the little thing can just sort of turn it around, and that a person is big enough, even though he's a little bird, he's big enough to apologize. I think it's beautiful.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It is, when you do meet people for the first time, we all form those first impressions, right? And we put them into a category. You're a nerd, you're a jock, or you're, and so I think it's nice when your characters surprise each other and say, wait a minute, I pegged you as this, but really, that's quite a useful skill, and that's not such a bad thing, and I might come across as being kind of boorish, but I don't really mean it, and it's just because I'm nervous, or I don't know any better, or I speak before I think, and I think a lot of us do that, and I think it is a nice section for kids to understand they can go back, and restart. Like, wait a minute, let's restart this, let's reconfigure this relationship.
Exactly. Just to have Robert say, "I say the dumbest things, I don't mean them." This was so, I thought it was very uplifting, and there are many parts in the book like that where you make the characters alive, you make them you show that they have feelings and that they care about important things and care about each other. I think you've done a brilliant job with these books.
you know, I really, really appreciate it. It was really fun writing this series. You know, the first series I wrote when the Orkney series began, you know, it was the Legends of Orkney series was the first series I wrote for my son. And that series was for a 12-year-old who really liked kind of dark fantasy. He liked the Percy Jackson series, but he also liked kind of the story of Anakin and Star Wars, you know, that sort of darker character making a left turn. So that whole Legends of Orkney series I wrote was for the little bit of the older reader, 12 to 14 in mind. And I do so many school visits. You know, I'm a literacy advocate, and I travel all over the country visiting schools. And so, you know, what I noticed is that I have some historical picture books that the K through 3 kids really wanted to read after I'd come and visit. And then I had the Legends of Orkney series, and I had all these 4th and 5th graders that were, you know, wanted to read something, you know, that had chapter book and had fantasy and action, all the things that I would talk about in my talks, but they maybe weren't quite ready for the Legends of Orkney series. And I have to tell you, Patsy, I had the best time writing the Witches of Orkney series because, my characters are closer to 9 and 10 years old in age, so they're a little bit sweeter. The action is a little bit more fun, and the dialogue, you know, is geared towards kind of a younger kid in mind, which just makes it, to me, even though there's action and adventure and creatures and things, you know, that happen, mysterious magic, all that stuff, it's still a little bit of a sweeter nature to the story, and that's honestly what I love most about writing this series. It's literally my favorite series to write because the action is just, you know, that it's just a more fun age to write for, I think.
Well, I think all of the characters are fascinating. You bring them to life, and of course in this book, Abigail is starting her second year at Tarkana Witch Academy, which, I mean, you know, always for kids to have a witch academy is fun, you know, and you make it, as you said, you make it interesting and not threatening in a bad way. So I love the characters, and I think the names that you've selected also are great. You know, sometimes people selecting characters for fantasy can overdo it and make it not relatable, but you have enough regular names in here that we can relate to and that I think come across very well. But then you have other character names that make it sound really mysterious and
exotic. It's nice to have a balance. It's just like witch names, you know, the witches are going to have kind of a unique sound to the names. Abigail's kind of an ordinary name, but there were so many witches in history that were named Abigail, I think, and Dara, Safina, or there's just different, you know, witches, but then some of the regular human, mortal, whatever people, you know, Robert, you know, it's a really basic name, but it's also a very strong, solid, you know.
Yeah, really perfect. Tell me, now, what's this fascination with the Orkneys?
So what happened is, okay, so my son, when he asked me to write him this book, okay, I wanted to get, you know, he really loved, like I said, like Rick Warden, so Greek mythology was a big passion of his, and at the time, Rick hadn't written a Norse mythology, and I was a huge fan of Norse mythology, having grown up reading the Lord of the Rings trilogy, which was, you know, really immersed in Norse mythology. So I thought it'd be really cool to write a book set in Norse mythology. And so using that sort of as a backdrop, I set out to research where sort of Norse mythology took place in the world. And of course, the Orkney Islands have a tremendous history with Norse mythology, but they also had a lot of local witch folklore. Okay, so there's all these stories in the Orkney Islands, the real Orkney Islands, embedded in witch folklore. And one of the things that they had was called the Ring of Brogar, which is those standing stones that, you know, eons ago, somebody set these stones in a circle, these massive, huge standing stones, and it's called the Ring of Brogar. And the local folklore said that it was, you know, that there were witches trapped inside the stone. And so that just set off a whole set of ideas for me. So my original Legends of Orkney series is tied to that, you know, witches trapped in there, and my main character accidentally releases those horrible, powerful witches, you know, which leads to book two and all these things. And so that was a big part of it. And the second part of it, Patsy, was I wanted to explain for my readers, why is there no magic in our world, right? Why is there no magic in Earth? You know, we talk about it all the time, we read about it all the time, and so using the Norse mythology and the nine realms of Odin, you know, sort of a basis for the story and the logic, my logic was, you know, what if at one point Odin was always known as the all-father of mankind, kind of like a protector and overseer of mankind. He had different reputations, but that was one of his reputations. And so Midgard being in the middle, you know, I said, what if back in the day, you know, back in the day when the gods, you know, walked the land, what if we did have magic in our world? But at one point, you know, magic threatened mankind, and, you know, the witches grew too powerful, and they threatened, you know, the very existence of mankind, and Odin steps in. What if he had to step in? And this is sort of talked about in the Rubicus prophecy. We kind of see that in the opening chapters where Hermodin is leading this battle against the witches, and they use Odin's stone to protect them, a gift from Odin to sort of protect them against the magic of the witches. But Odin says, it's gone too far. It's too much. You know, this time could have ended badly. And so rather than, so he was going to take away all magic from Earth, just destroy all magic, just take it away because he had that power. And they said, but there are really good people that have magic. What about them? And so as a compromise, Odin scoops up. Okay, this is a theory. See, Hermodin was the king of the Orkney Islands way back in the day. And so what if Hermodin offered part of his kingdom as a sanctuary and said, take these islands and let all creatures of mankind, you know, of magic, you know, on these islands, and you take them up into your magic, you know, realm of Asgard, and, you know, magic can continue. So for me, the Orkney in my world is this pocket world, you know, of magic that Odin has protected and taken out of our world, so essentially lifted these islands out of our world and taken with it all creatures of magic, and that's why, you know, we don't really have magic in our world anymore. That was the logic, and that was the fascination with Orkney. I used a lot of the original names and places of Orkney and created some new ones, and kind of overlapped it, you know, as if it's kind of like a mirror kind of realm there. And that sort of explains for me and for my reader why we don't have magic in our world.
Well, I think you've done a great job. Now, have you been to the Orkneys?
I was within sighting distance. Like you, I've been to Scotland, and from the Isle of Skye, I think wherever I was, you can actually see the Orkney Islands, and I'd really love to go visit. I promised my son we would go and visit one day. Not that there's a whole lot to see there. They're inhabited, of course, but not have a huge population.
Yeah, you can fly into what they call the mainland, which I think there are like 20 islands or something like that. Yeah. And it's funny, you know, they are in the middle of nowhere, but they have so much history. I mean, even the Romans got there. I mean, you know, it's crazy, you know, how everybody was sort of trying to get there. And of course, it's a strategic location. So it is actually fascinating because it was very important in both World War I, World War II. The weather is actually very mild because of the Gulf Stream. Uh-huh. And so people don't realize that up there in the north of Scotland, in the middle of nowhere, we have these islands, and it is, you know, I think they should invite you over there and do a day for you.
Right, exactly. I know. I've tried to make them as famous as I can.
That's right. And you can, you know, you can actually lead a tour. You know, there are authors who are doing that now. They're leading tours to locations in their books.
Yeah.
And it's fun for the fans, and it's fun, you know, for the author.
Sure.
So yeah, that's a nice idea for you. Take a whole bunch of people up there and help the Orkneys, because they still are known for making good, you know, they had an interesting farming communities there and grew in the days when I was there, the excellent beef. So I don't know what's happening up there now. Probably the oil industry actually probably made them rich. So, you know, wouldn't that be fun if they named a whole day after you and brought you up there?
There you go. Well, the fun part about writing this series was that I'd already built the world. And I think one of the hardest things as an author is to do the world building when you're writing a fantasy novel and it's set in a fantasy realm. So one of the fun things I had when I set up this whole series in the Legends of Orkney series and the original books that I wrote, I had built this world and built sort of all the places and creatures and races and things that live there. And so when I wrote the Witches of Orkney is actually a prequel series. It takes place before the Legends of Orkney series, and it takes my main character's mom back to when she was, excuse me, a 9-year-old. So Abigail is my main character's mother, and so we go back in time and we see her as a young witchling and kind of understand more of the background on her. So that was a really fun part about writing the series, is just that, you know, able to borrow all of the sort of elements that I'd already created and was very familiar with, and then expand on it and really go deeper into the background of the witches and to really understand some of the bad blood between her and this other witch, you know, named Mandera, and really get a better sense of all the story behind the other story that I wrote. And I think that's been the most fun for me as an author, is to work within the parameters of a story I've already written and try to go back and make up and expand and delve deeper into the story behind the story, even though I didn't necessarily have any of these things formulated at the time that I wrote the original story. So that's really been a lot of fun for me.
Well, I love the book. The cover is of the new one, which is the Rubicus Prophecy, is really great. And on your website, you have actually a little video, a book trailer.
Yeah, I know. I have an amazing book trailer. All the art. I have a really great artist. His name is Jonathan Stroh, and he's done all of the artwork for my series, going back to the Legends of Working series. And so he's so talented, and he's so familiar with my characters. And so we're able to take all the beautiful artwork that he does and animate it and create, you know, a really beautiful book trailer. So if you guys get a chance to see it, it's on my, you can go to YouTube or you can go to my website. And there's a book trailer for the Blue Witch and also for the Rubicus Prophecy.
Well, I love the Blue Witch, too, because I thought that... I just love that cover too.
Again, much more playful, you know, and you know, really, I think engaging for young kids. If you have readers that are 8, 9, 10 years old, then you know they see the cover and they just instantly see the fun in it, the magic and the creatures. All of it is right there on the cover.
Well, I think that really everyone should go to the website, because it is really, they are the best book trailers I have seen, and I'm talking even the most best-selling authors who have, you know, spent a fortune on book trailers do not compare to your book trailers. They are really magnificent.
Yeah, thank you. And that's really because of the art. You know, you just can't, when you have art that good, the way Jonathan, like I said, draws the images and everything, it's just, it would be a shame not to use it. That's my theory. It'd be a shame not to put it into a video and have it animated and really, really showcase it.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And the name is Elaine Adams. Elaine, I'm pronouncing it right. You like it pronounced?
Yeah, Elaine. Yeah, Elaine.
A-L-A-N-E Adams. And the website, A-L-A-N-E, ElaineAdams.com. And it's really, all of your books are listed there. The two trailers are so good. I watched them a couple of times simply because, you know, you have to watch them a couple of times to see all the artwork. It's just so beautiful. And so the new book is the Rubicus Prophecy, but I think everyone will also want to read and of course watch the trailer for the Blue Witch, which you know, you're saying a lot of witches here, is really, really great. And you have also some wonderful picture books.
Yes, I do. I do. They're so different. They're set in 1920s historical Americana. You know, it's they're stories that my dad told me. My dad was born in the 1920s, and a few years ago, he was about 93, 94. He told me some stories about his childhood that I'd never heard before, and they really inspired me to want to really, you know, sort of let kids today kind of understand what life was like for a boy growing up in the 1920s. And they're great conversation pieces. You can actually see Christian Slater read The Coal Thief on Storyline Online. It's an amazing video program that they have, putting picture books in the hands of great actors and stuff. And it's a really, you can also see me read one of the books, The Circus Thief, at my website, another great sort of video to watch. And the books just really bring to life, again, a great artist and I have Lauren Gallegos, she's my illustrator, did an amazing job, you know, bringing the characters to life and helping to illustrate really, I think, an Americana of a time past where kids can really understand, hey, look at the kitchen, there's no electricity, there's no refrigerator, there's no microwave, this is, you know, life is really different, so...
Well, I think you're doing a wonderful job getting kids interested in reading and having the right attitude also. That's, you know, that's just as important. As I said, with your dialogue, I just saw that there's heart and there's love and there's joy in your writing. And, you know, I named this program, you know, because I wanted people to find the joy on paper. And I see that you have, and also your wonderful work to promote reading, and you're available to come to schools, and they can also see that on your website, because you are just trying to get out there and getting more kids to read.
Yeah, you know, I'm a literacy advocate. I run a literacy foundation, Rise Up Foundation, and so the foundation is able to support my travel, and so I visit schools all over the country. I just got back from visiting 3 states last week. I was in Georgia, South Carolina, and Tennessee, visited 20 schools. I visited over 40 schools so far this school year, visited over 100 last year. So, you know, really it's about getting kids excited about reading, trying to inspire them to want to pick up a book, any book, not just my book, and really kind of continue to spread that message about why reading is so powerful.
Because, as you say, reading is a superpower.
It really is, Patsy.
Everyone, go to Elaine Adams' website. Her new book is called The Rubicus Prophecy. It's available wherever books are sold. Any kid in your life will love this book. Believe me, even mid-teens, teenagers, and adults will love this book. I think it's just beautifully written by a very, very talented author. And I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Elaine.
You got it, Patsy. Thanks so much. You have a great day.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Wow. Wonderful, wonderful. More and more authors are doing little videos on their websites just to make them more interesting, but hers are the best. I haven't seen anybody do anything better than hers. So check out her website. It's Elaine, A-L-A-N-E, Adams, and you will be impressed. And then you will definitely want to buy the books and read them to your kids in your life, and you will enjoy them too. And the nice thing about when a book is written so that it interests the adult too, it gives you something to talk about with the kids. So you know what they're, first of all, you should always know what they're reading so that they're not reading things that aren't appropriate. But definitely with Elaine, you will be thrilled with her writing, and she's just fantastic. So, okay, well, this is exciting for me. I'm getting ready. As I said, I'm going to Dallas. I'm going to be a cowboy. Well, cowgirl, you know, we lived in Texas a long time, so I have all the gear. I have cowboy boots. I have cowboy hats. And we're going to add a little glitz and glamour. I have to put some rhinestones on my cowboy hat, maybe. And just so that we have lots of fun over there at BoucherCon. And I will come back with a whole bunch of authors to invite back to Joy on Paper so that we can have more books to talk about. Oh, we always need to have more books to talk about. Meanwhile, NaNoWriMo is coming up, National Novel Writing Month. Are you prepared? You should go to their website and check it out. And last year, I did it, and I won. And you can do it, too. It's fun. You know, and I actually had to write. I didn't have the whole month of November because I'm big on Thanksgiving, had lots of company. And so I had to finish by the 25th of November. So I had only 25 days. You could probably take the whole 30 days. But anyway, have fun and go to NaNoWriMo and check it out. Because remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're really lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a streaming video, a major motion picture, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. Like, I hope, Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mysteries, which reminds me, it's Halloween. You should be reading a Witch City Mystery because they are so much fun from Carol J. Perry, available at every Barnes & Noble across the country. Think about that, everyone, or online, of course, wherever books are sold. So check out Carol J. Perry and make sure you listen in on Thursday to my pre-recorded show. It's going to be fun. And say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. And he's saluting me, and I'm saluting you. And everybody, have an absolutely wonderful day. Bye-bye now.